we've got some big supporters here in Congress, and one of them is here, and it's Congresswoman Lofgren from California, and I'd like to turn the floor over to
her.
Thank
you. Well, I'm going to be very brief. I have people waiting for me in my office. It's great to see Bart. Bart knows his way around the Capitol and can guide you on the efforts that you need to make here. First, I just want to say thank you. We have had a small group of fusion supporters here in the House, and we need your help. I just be blunt. I mean, we have had a decrease in funding in the president's budget, as I think you're aware. We did rally a bipartisan effort to try and restore some of the funding, but really, especially with the sequester, the impact on fusion science is dire. You know, it always kind of bemuses me when people say, well, you know, they've tried to do fusion, but they never got there. It's like, well, if we spent what California spends on energy in a week on the science, I think we'd make better progress than not funding the science and then saying, well, gosh, you know, those scientists haven't produced yet. So your efforts are essential. I will say that there's a willingness on the part of the House to be guided. Last August, when we were facing really a wipeout, both on the magnetic and the inertial confinement side, I said, we need to stand up for this. And in 24 hours, I got 100 members of Congress to sign a letter standing up for fusion science. And Spartan knows that's not very often do you see that level of support. So I think to some extent it's an educational effort. You know, the number of members who say, was that cold fusion? But it's also a visionary thing. We know that we have a serious climate change challenge. And if we expect to get our planet out of this situation, what you're doing is an essential element. So I just want to say thank you. I'm going to run off to my next meeting. I hope that I'll be seeing you throughout the day. Dr. Gutman, Ben Gutman is here. He will be taking notes for me. If there's anything you think I can do, I'm eager to hear it because I'm all in on this effort. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Some might ask, who's the American Security Project and what do we do? This is our formal mission. But to kind of encapsulate this a little bit, we take national security issues and study them and then put out, we are an educational institute, so we put out papers that talk about these issues in a nonpartisan or a bipartisan way. Next slide, please. You can see here who our founders were. It's been an exciting last 60 days for us. Because our two of our principal founders, one's now Secretary of State, the other Secretary of Defense, and they are the ones who got this together in 2004, 2005, with the concept that if you brought up such subjects as nuclear security, energy change, climate security, terrorism, asymmetric operations, American competitiveness, just to name a few, automatically a lot of people chose a side. And it got slanted one way or the other, particularly as you probably know, if you mention climate change, the Tea Party stands up and goes crazy. What we propose to do is to take on those topics and put out papers that study the facts. Put out the facts, and you can then argue them one way or the other. We don't lean right. We don't lean left. We've got an equal number of Republicans and Democrats on our board. You can see our board here. But we also put in a significant number of flag officers from all four services. And we did this to lend validity to the national security perspective on the American Security Project. And you can see here Admiral Fox Fallon, one of them, former Central Command combatant commander. Dan Chrisman, who is the former superintendent of West Point. John Castelaw was basically the CFO for the Marine Corps. Lester Lyles, now on the board of General Dynamics. Claudia Kennedy from the Army. And of course, not the least of which, was Vice Admiral Lee Gunn, who is our president and was the former Inspector General of the Marine Corps. Next slide, please.
I'm happy to be the least of which.
Yeah. So today we put together a panel. What we want to talk about today, of course, is fusion. And our opinion at the American Security Project is, one, it's underfunded. Two, a lot of people just don't understand it. And we really feel that it needs a kickstart, a big kickstart. We think it is a part of the big solution to our energy problems in this country. Of course, in this day and age of fracking and drilling and all this kind of business, and I go around the country a lot talking about energy, You get a lot of people saying, oh, we're going to be energy independent. We don't have to worry about this. That is absolutely untrue, and we have papers that prove that. But today, we want to put out a 10-year plan for fusion. And we're excited about it. It's got a lot of controversy associated with it. But we feel if it's appropriately funded, if you put the right effort behind it, fusion power is the solution to a lot of our energy problems in this country. We are producing fusion power today, albeit in small doses in various places, but it needs the funding and needs the effort. With that, I'm going to turn over to Vice Admiral Lee Gunn, who is the president of ASP and the president of the Institute of Public Research at CNA, and he will talk the national security perspective on fusion.
Thanks very much, Steve. And thank you all for being here. One of the daunting challenges I face here is that this is a very knowledgeable audience. You folks are either already acquainted with what the challenges are and what the opportunities look like in a variety of ways, but I'm going to reinforce some of those from a national security perspective, and I think in that regard I'm going to do a pretty good job of representing the view of the members of the board, and in particular the members of the board who have served their adult lives in uniform and in various places. So without further ado, let me enumerate a few challenges, discuss each of these in turn, and then talk about the opportunities toward the end. And in a real sense here, I'm Stuart Prager's warm-up act, and so I will not take too much of your time, but I'd be happy to talk about national security and energy and the issues that I'm going to bring up with you either during my brief time up here or later as well. The demand is insatiable for energy. That won't change in my view. The security of energy supplies is both important to the country and one of the principal functions of America's military. We would like to see, those of us who've served in uniform all our lives, would like very much to see the burden that is imposed and the limitations that are placed on America's foreign policy and military demand reduced. And part of that is establishing ourselves in a renewed leadership position approaching the new energy economy. I tell audiences, there will be a new energy economy. We can argue about when the fossil fuel that we know about on our planet will be depleted. We can argue about when the demand for that energy source crosses with the supply. I got all that. But the fact is, there will be a new energy economy in the world, and America will either lead it or follow others. And so that is a very serious concern on the part of the members of the board at ASP, and in particular, the military members. Economic stability is essential for our growth in this country. Sustainability of the environment is much more important than you would think, given the degree to which it is featured or not featured in the conversation about energy. And I'll talk a little bit about aging infrastructure and the opportunity that presents if we're willing to invest in the kind of science and engineering and technology and materials development that are needed to move us to a new place. Next, Brett. The demand, as I said, is insatiable. 47% increase over a period of 25 years across the world, with the majority of the growth, or a large part of the growth, being in the non-OECD Asian nations, primarily India and China. But there's a growing demand in the United States as well, and of course we're increasingly able, through natural gas and fracking of oil production, to meet that demand on our own. It's really important to me, and I believe to the ASP board, and to the folks who spend a lot of time thinking about this, that we view the relative abundance that we're now benefiting from in oil and natural gas produced in North America as an opportunity and a breather, and not the solution to the problem. This is a chance for us to take a deep breath and invest in the research and the design and the technology necessary to move us into that leadership position where we think we belong in the world as we move toward a new energy economy. Next chart. Of my 35 years in the Navy, I spent 17 years on sea duty and 11 years at sea day for day, and I spent an awful lot of it here. This is in the Straits of Hormuz, and between the Bab el-Mandeb, the Gulf of Oman, the Straits of Hormuz, the Straits of Malacca, the Sunda Strait in Indonesia, these are the lifelines through which a great deal of the petroleum that fires the world's economy passes. And my service and Steve's service, the Marine Corps, spent an awful lot of time ensuring that these sea lanes keep open. In the meantime, oil dependence, as I said earlier, undermines many aspects of American foreign policy. We don't have the latitude to do what we would like to do absent our dependence on this source. And we have been involved in here for a long time. And in the 1980s, a direct involvement was what was referred to as the tanker wars, where the U.S. Navy and Coast Guard actually took up escort duty to take tankers through the Straits of Hormuz and the associated waters. And why did we do that? Most of those ships weren't even U.S. flagships. Many of them were headed here, though, or were headed to the ports of our allies to fuel the economy on which we think we all depend. Next view, Greg. Economic instability. We are not in control of our own destiny with regard to the price stability of energy, even when it's produced in the United States, but when the sources for that production come from elsewhere. As a matter of fact, when the creation of energy is the result of the movement of product to places that produce the energy, we will always be subject to some degree to price fluctuations across the world, many of which are driven by outsized demand in places that we don't have much influence. So at the end of the day, when we talk about fusion here, at the end of this session, that's going to be a key element, that the production and the process of generating the materials for production can be here and not exported. And if you generate it here and you distribute it here in our own country, you are not likely to be subject to the same kind of insecurity and uncertainty that now burdens us. And it's that uncertainty that creates such problems for American businesses. Next view, Greg. Environmental stability. A lot of the costs of doing business the way we do today and the way we've done business for so long are externalities. There are costs associated with the production and consumption of fossil fuels that will be borne by future generations, but don't get reflected in the price that we pay to use that energy. This is an enormous burden, I think, for our country, and whatever approach we take in getting to the new energy economy, the new energy paradigm in the world needs to take this into account. And we need to reflect the cost of these externalities in a way that allows us to make a realistic comparison between the way we do things now and the way we would like to do things and invest in the ability to do things in the future. And with regard to the changing missions, I don't think that we can associate any particular weather event with climate change, but we can certainly associate the increasing frequency of these weather events with climate change. And these weather events often cause the kinds of stresses and strains in our own country, but certainly in the rest of the world, that have resulted in the necessary engagement of the U.S. military to help bring about a solution to the problem. So that is another aspect of this for us. Next view, Greg. We're going to have to invest in our future. And I realize that in these tough times, this is a more difficult argument than ever to make. But the fact is that in 2009, we spent about $18 billion total in new energy the entire collection of new energy technology research and development. The Chinese spent over $34 billion. And so they recognize the steady drumbeat of increasing demand in their own country for energy, and they are taking steps to address that demand in a way that I think is much more far-sighted than sometimes we're able to do in our own country. And this is just a little factoid at the bottom about the relative priorities that we've established. I don't think ever with giving them any thought, it's just a consequence of a collection of things we've done. And so we're going to have to get our act together and focus much better on the kind of outcomes that we want to see. Next view, Greg. So there is some opportunity here. I said at the beginning, I talk about challenges and opportunity. You can look at the aging infrastructure in the United States in terms of production of energy as a set of obstacles, and it certainly is in some ways. On the other hand, if you flip that over and talk about the opportunities that will arise because we will be forced to change out these aging plants in the relatively near future, then this is a time that R&D is all that much more important and will be consequential in the new ways that we choose, the new places we build to create energy. Next view, Greg. And demands continue to go up, as I said, and so this gap between our generating capacity and the demand that we see in our own country is growing. Next chart. So this is just an illustration of some of the facilities that need to be replaced. It just gives some scale to the kinds of changes we need to make. And next, you grab. So Richard Nixon said in the 70s that these were the aspirations that he laid out. Other presidents since have laid out aspirations that were similar. We're not there. It's going to take, in my view, dedication on the part of the administration and the Congress and the certain agencies in the administration that are charged with carrying out energy responsibilities. And it's also going to take a lot of information for the American people to understand how important it is to devote a certain portion of the resources that they ask that the government apportion to research and development. That's my piece. And so, Steve, over to you or to Stuart.
Sure. Admiral, I got it. Thank you very much, Admiral. And thanks for the national security perspective on this. What I didn't say at the beginning is the ASP doesn't do primary research. We basically do secondary research. We collate. So we have to rely on those who are the primary researchers. We aren't the fusion experts of the world, but we have one of the fusion experts of the world here today. And that's Dr. Stuart Prager, who's the director of the Princeton Plasma Physics Lab. And Stuart, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you. First, let me say I'm very appreciative for the perspective that American Security Project brings to fusion. They bring the perspective that's much larger than those of us that work technically in the field, as was embodied in Admiral Dunn's comments, the perspective of the impact on fusion and the overall national well-being and national security of the country. And that kind of perspective, I think, is invaluable in these discussions. I'm happy to synopsize for you where we've come in fusion energy, the path from physics to energy. The program was born as a physics program. It's been largely a physics program. And we are ready, as General Cheney says, to kick into high gear and make it really an energy development program. Looking around, some of my slides may be a bit too elementary for some of you. The sun, as we all know, is a natural fusion reactor in the sky. This gave the inspiration for the pioneers in our field to think of making a sun on Earth. The sun is a hot gas of billions of particles. It's called a plasma. A gas of hot particles is called a plasma. And in the sun and all the other stars, the particles undergo nuclear fusion reactions that generates as the main generator of energy in the whole universe. The temperature in the center of the sun is 10 million degrees. In a fusion reactor, we have to do better. We have to make a plasma that's 100 million degrees to get enough energy produced in a small volume. And we need to take a plasma on Earth and surround it by a material. So our problem is a bigger challenge than the problem of creating the sun, and we have to do it in a shorter amount of time. Fusion energy is one of the most difficult science and engineering undertakings ever in humankind. It required the development of a new field of science, the field of plasma physics. When our pioneers began the study of fusion 40, 50 years ago, this was a burgeoning field. It is now a mature area of science, and we've come very far along the path. The fusion reaction, let me just tell you, the basic reaction that will be the core of a fusion reactor takes a nucleus of a deuterium atom and a nucleus of a tritium atom, smashes them together at high speed. That's why you need high temperature. Out comes a new particle, the nucleus of a helium atom, and a fast-moving particle called a neutron. It's a very intense energy source. There's a multiplication of about 500 from the parent nuclei to the daughter nuclei, we sometimes say. So it's a very intense nuclear source. This is the basic source of the energy. Mass is converted to energy. Why is fusion such a quest for the entire world? It's because when it exists, it will be a nearly ideal energy source. It's nearly inexhaustible. The basic fuel comes from water. There's enough for millions of years. You need lithium to breed the tritium in the reactor, and lithium is plentiful in the Earth's crust and also in the oceans. Because the natural resource is abundant and essentially inexhaustible, it will be available to all nations that have the technological capability. And as was so clarified in Admiral Gunn's comments, we hope this will reduce the conflict over natural resources. Also, fusion is characterized by very small land use. It is almost perfectly clean. It contributes zero greenhouse gases, zero contribution to global climate change, no acid rain. It is extremely safe. It's passively inherently safe. There's no chance for any sort of runaway reaction. At any moment, there's enough fuel in the reactor to cause fusion reactions to go on only for minutes. So there's no chance of a runaway. It's hard to keep the plasma hot. So there's no chance of any runaway or explosion. There are only very short-lived radioactive waste, orders of magnitude less difficult than an fission reactor. And they're not the products of the nuclear fusion reaction. They occur because the surrounding structure becomes mildly radioactive. So it's just about ideal, and that's what's kept this quest alive for many years. And when it is generating electricity and energy on a broader scale, it will really be transformative for the world. There are two approaches to fusion energy. First, one is called inertial fusion energy, and the other, magnetic fusion energy. I work in magnetic fusion energy, and we'll talk mostly about that. But let me first mention inertial fusion energy. In inertial fusion energy, there's a very small millimeter-sized frozen pellet of fusion fuel that in the most highly developed approach is zapped on all sides with very intense laser beams. The lasers compress the fuel, it heats, and you get a micro explosion that generates fusion energy. And in a fusion reactor based on this technique, it will be like an internal combustion engine where it just repeats 10 times a second in these little micro explosions. It's funded mainly for defense applications because of its scientific applications to nuclear weapons. Here is the pellet. It's a little tiny pellet. In the most heavily invested approach, the pellet is placed in a little tiny can. And in the scheme, the can is irradiated in an experiment I'll show you by almost 200 laser beams that go into the can, and then this pellet gets bathed in this laser light that gets converted to x-rays and the pellet implodes. This little tiny pellet, which is just a millimeter, is placed in this very, very big target chamber. This is a target chamber that is now functioning, and it is, you may have heard, the National Ignition Facility at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. The target is going, that little millimeter target in that big target chamber is bombarded by the most powerful laser in the world. And experiments are underway right now with the goal of showing that this pellet can be ignited as a fusion source. So this is a very exciting experiment that's underway. And there's complementary research going on at the Naval Research Labs, at the Sandia National Lab, the University of Rochester, and the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. But looking at the sun, you might imagine a complementary approach where you just take a little sun and you put it in a box here on Earth and you heat it to 100 million degrees and out comes heat. Well, this won't work. You can't just put it in a box because what holds the sun together is its self-gravity. It's so massive, and we can't possibly make anything so massive on Earth where gravity plays any role whatsoever. So what we do is we take a plasma, we bend it into the shape of a donut, and we confine it with a magnetic force field. So these red bars are magnets. So we have a donut-shaped plasma, not spherical, but it's donut-shaped. And it's confined in a very strong magnetic field made by these magnets, a strong magnetic cage. That's the basic idea. It's come very far. Here is the biggest tokamak operating in the world in England. And this indicates technologically and how far we've come. Here's a person inside the vacuum chamber. You can see the vacuum chamber is heavily armored to withstand the heat from the 100 million degree plasma. Here are our antennas that inject electromagnetic waves into the plasma to heat it up. And when the plasma is produced, the person's ejected and the machine is evacuated and the plasma is installed. Come very far. Looking from the outside in, a fusion reactor will look like any other central power plant, whether it's coal-fired or current nuclear fission. The only difference is that the heat, instead of made by burning coal, is made by this fusion furnace. The neutrons come out, they heat a blanket that then can produce steam and turn a turbine that then makes electricity and connects on to our existing power grid. So from the outside in, it's conventional, but the inside is highly conventional. It's a fusion furnace. We've come very, very far. And I'll just show you some symbolic indicators for how far we've come. We routinely produce plasmas at these truly astronomical temperatures. In fact, here is a piece of data from decades ago. Temperature plotted versus distance throughout the donut, and you can see it peaks at 300 million degrees. So we routinely, every day in the laboratory, we make 100 million degree plasmas. And we don't only make them, but we manipulate them with remarkable care and finesse to optimize the properties of the plasma. We've produced fusion energy on an experimental basis. Here in 1994, in the United States, there was a milestone. An experiment was operated with the fusion fuel. And it was heated with almost 40 million watts of power. And out came 10 million watts of fusion power for a fraction of a second. For less than a second, 10 million watts of fusion power was produced according to theoretical expectation. This was a big milestone. 3 years later, in England, the United Kingdom, they upped that to 16 million watts for a second. So we produced large amounts of fusion power on an experimental basis. There's been a huge advance over the years. We've gone from milliwatts when I entered the field in 1970 to these 10 or 16 million watts produced. This is a logarithmic scale. So we've just gone right on up with very rapid progress by this measure. Underlying all this progress is a huge increase in scientific understanding. You may notice that this saturates in the late 90s. We've just stalled out and have not continued producing fusion power in the laboratory. The reason it stalled out is not because of any science. We could have gone further. We had the scientific know-how and proposed machines to do that. It's been stalled simply by lack of the government providing us with the facility to take it further. Had we taken it further, in the 1990s, today we would have been producing a plasma that produces more energy out than in and be very much more close to commercialization, but the money wasn't there. These results in the 1990s gave rise to a lot of publicity, justifiably nationwide, articles all over the place. Here's an article by George Will. These results triggered an increase of investment and effort in fusion energy research worldwide. The world took notice and started to invest, with the exception of the United States. The United States at this time stalled out in their investment in fusion, and then it's been constant. And the rest of the world has bypassed us. So we didn't take notice of our own results. I think it's fair to say that the scientific community has high confidence that we can indeed generate abundant fusion power on the scale of a commercial power plant. no question that we have the know-how to do it. There are questions of how quickly we can do it, how attractive it will be, how economically competitive it will be. Those are the kinds of questions that have to be answered, not whether we can do it. We know the R&D steps that are needed to proceed. One major next step that you might have heard about is a big international step, reflecting the world's interest in this opportunity. And it's called the ITER experiment, the International ITER experiment. When it was conceived, it was called International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor, but the marketers said that doesn't sound good. Now, ITER is Latin for the way, so it stands for the way. It will generate 500 million watts of fusion power, enough fusion power to power a small city if it was connected to the grid. It will do it, it's designed to do it for a brief amount of time here, about 500 seconds or a bit longer. It will study the key physics and technology for fusion and produce the first burning plasma where it produces more energy out than in by a factor of 10. It involves a partnership that covers half the world's population. The European Union is the host, and it will be in France, and they are contributing 45%, and then you can read down the list. All of the rest of us, including the United States, are 9% partners. This is the facility. It's a power plant scale. Here's a person. There would be a big plasma in this dome right here. Stare at that for a moment. And this is some of the indication of where it's at. This is a building to produce one of the magnets. The headquarters building is now constructed. These are isolators to protect against earthquakes, upon which the fusion machine will be stacked. And here's an artist's conception of the site when it's ready. So this is indicates the reality and the world's interest in fusion. The construction cost, the US share of the construction cost, is about $2.5 billion over 10 years. Now, ITER alone will not bring fusion power to the US or to the world. There are additional R&D steps are necessary. And a vigorous US program in fusion is needed to solve the remaining challenges and to bring fusion to the United States. And the US government right now has no official plan, no official roadmap to get to fusion energy. It has a scientific research program to develop the knowledge base, but not a real plan to get there. But scientists in the community, in the fusion community, have gotten together from several institutions, and we think about what the steps would be to get there. So this is a roadmap to fusion energy, not a US roadmap, but a roadmap discussed in the US among the scientific community. And for simplicity, we divide it into three eras. The present era, which I might mention has three major fusion facilities, at General Atomics in San Diego, at Princeton, and at MIT, and an accompanying physics research program spread around the country. These facilities are world-leading facilities, and world-leading results, but in 5 or 10 years, they will be surpassed by the new facilities abroad that I will get to. 2020 to 2035 is the final R&D era for fusion, which will be characterized by ITER, a research program in the United States, and as you'll hear from the American Security Project, we have a concept for a facility that in 10 years will begin operation to produce demonstrable amounts of fusion energy on an experimental basis here in the United States. With this research, we will be ready in 2035 to begin a full-scale demonstration power plant that will be a commercial prototype, a pre-commercial power plant. So fusion energy in our lifetime is certainly possible. How much does it cost? Well, this program, which is very aggressive compared to the current one, for the magnetic fusion development would be about, roughly speaking, $1.5 billion a year. This is 0.1% of the annual US expenditure in energy of $1.5 trillion. So an aggressive fusion program for magnetic would be, for every $1,000 we spend on energy a year, take $1 and put it into this research. But the US is at a turning point in fusion research. We have a funding challenge in that to fulfill our commitments to the International ITER project, the fusion program needs more funds.
to deliver the hardware we need to deliver. So funding for Fusion must increase to meet our ITER commitments and to bring us the scientific benefits from ITER. But in these budget times, if that budget increase is at the sacrifice of the domestic program, it will destroy the U.S. Fusion effort, and we won't even be able to benefit from ITER. So there's a conundrum facing the U.S. Fusion program from a funding point of view. What's the international context? Fusion research in other nations is surging, particularly in Asia and the European Union. There's an escalating activity in magnetic fusion. What I'm showing here are the newest machines in the world in China, a superconducting tokamak in Korea, and in Japan. All of these are superconducting. They run with superconducting magnets, meaning the plasma can persist indefinitely for long periods of time. And in England, they continue to run the largest tokamak in the world. This is where the new facilities are in the world. Not only are there new recent facilities operating, but Japan is building a new large facility. These facilities are cost, in US terms, about $1 billion or two to build. Germany is building a new, I would call it a 21st century design, and ITER is under construction in France. The rest of the world has entered what you might call the superconducting era of fusion research, where they can keep plasmas around indefinitely. Not only have they built facilities and are building facilities, but they are planning for their demonstration power plant. And here, for example, is a slide taken from a talk by a Korean colleague. In Korea, they are now identifying sites in their nation where they can house the demonstration, the Korean demonstration fusion reactor that they are looking forward to housing. And they've identified sites that have good access to power transmission lines. The same is true in China, where they are entering, you might call, the Apollo project for fusion for China. And the same is true in the European Union. And I hate to say it, but the United States is this distinct among the developed countries in our absence of a roadmap for fusion. So the US, although from the inception of the fusion program, it has been arguably the world leader in this field, where we've developed the science for it and are ready to develop fusion as an energy source, we're about to give away our knowledge to the rest of the world. We still, at this moment in time, have a fusion science workforce that's second to none, but we are on the verge, and it might occur with the budget this year, of falling behind to a second tier. We're always asked, well, so what? Why don't we just buy reactors from China and Korea? Why not? And the answer to this more falls, I think, within the expertise of the American Security Project, but I will say, if we did this, we will suffer. We will not have control of our own energy supply. We'll have to buy it from overseas. We will not be able to compete economically in what surely will be a new and huge energy market. We will not be competitive scientifically in this field and all that spins off from it. And also, actually, fusion energy is not here yet, and the rest of the world needs the US contributions. If we're not in the game, it will slow even the development of fusion in the rest of the world. So I think it's a bad idea to just give up and buy from Korea and China. The other question always asked, fusion has always been 30 years away, and it still is. What do you say to that? I say two things. One, there's some truth to that attack, and the challenge is more profound than was realized by the pioneers in our field 50 years ago. They didn't realize how deep a scientific challenge is and how much we had to develop a whole new field of science. You want to cure cancer, you've got to develop genetics and microbiology. You want to get to fusion, you've got to develop the field of plasma physics. Now, 50 years later, we have developed that field, and the knowledge base is mostly in hand. But the needed funding that the pioneers said was needed never even closely materialized. And if you look at the progress in the field that the pioneers predicted, as a function of the money spent, the predictions roughly came true. All across the world, nations have convened review panels of outside scientific experts, those from outside the fusion community, to judge fusion, and all across the world, our readiness to now proceed aggressively toward a demonstration power plant has been confirmed, and that is why other worlds have taken this step. So to conclude, just want to remind you that scientists are confident that we can make fusion power for large-scale energy use. Research challenges remain that will determine the economic attractiveness. Surely, if there's a societal will, we can have a clean, safe, abundant domestic fusion energy source in our lifetime. I don't want to trivialize the challenge. It's not as easy as building a shopping mall. Okay? There are still significant R&D steps, but we know how to do it. And the rough annual cost for both magnetic and inertial fusion energy is about 0.2% of our annual energy expenditure. So with that, I'll turn it back to ASP.
Stuart, thank you. I appreciate that presentation. Even a Marine could understand us being laymen. And you might ask at the end of this, okay, what are we going to do about it? And so that's where ASP steps in, and we've got a plan. And we've detailed this plan in the report that you have here. It was authored by Andrew Holland, and I'm going to introduce Andrew and have him present the plan.
Steve, thank you, and I'll do it sitting down here. I should also mention that I was a part of it, but also Nick Cunningham, our policy analyst, was a key part of it, and we couldn't have gotten it done without him. So we've seen the problem from Admiral Gunn, and we've seen the promise from Dr. Prager. So what's the plan? And that's what we'd like to talk about here. And I know we only have a little bit of time, so I'd encourage you all to grab the report on your way out and read that and learn from that. But we detail it in full. And I should mention that this is ASP's plan. We've certainly consulted with a lot of people throughout the field, but this is we speak for ourselves here, and we think that there's importance for where to go. So why does ASP support fusion? Fusion is clean, safe, virtually unlimited, secure. It will spark monumental scientific and technological achievements. And as we saw, America's competitors are hard at work. I think we've made the case that this is an important program, an important energy source for the future that we need to be investing in now. And the longer we wait to invest in it, the longer we'll wait to get it. Next slide. Fusion is, it's important to say that fusion is not just something for the future as well, though. This is already present in 47 out of 50 states. There's over 775 research institutions across the country involved in fusion research. Many more supporting positions, supporting contractors. Some of them are here in the room today. You know, California, Tennessee, Massachusetts are some of the leading states, but also, as you can see on the graph, and I'd encourage you to go on our website, you can zoom in more closely and you can see specifically even which districts these subcontractors are in. And this is a living graph as well. This is something that we're constantly updating and adding to when we talk to more people, when we learn more businesses involved in this. This is an important thing to remember. This is not just for the future. This is important now. And as Stuart said, next slide, the U.S. is falling behind. We've seen these pictures in Stuart's presentation. There is no superconducting machines in the United States, and as of now, there's no plan to. And in the future, we're concerned that we'll have to outsource our science and outsource our energy sources to the countries that are making the investments now, whether it's China, South Korea, Japan, Germany, others. We can't afford to fall behind. So you can see on this graph, the business as usual plan for fusion has demonstration plants in the 2040s leading to commercialization in the 2050s. This is given current budgets and current plans. We think that getting to commercial viability by mid-century is not soon enough. It's not soon enough because it won't meet the challenge of national security, won't meet the challenge of environmental change. We're afraid that this is simply too long in the future. We have to act on issues like climate change, issues like energy security, issues like our leadership now. We can't simply wait for the next generation or our grandchildren's generation. We need to get to work now. So America must commit to developing fusion energy on an accelerated time frame. And we think that this is realistic. We believe that this is not some fairy tale. This is not something that we really want to happen, therefore we're trying to will it into existence. No, we believe that this is a credible plan for America's energy future. First, it starts with a national commitment. We have to realize that this is an imperative, and Congress should begin by authorizing an accelerated push to develop fusion power. This will take a new authorization. It should start from Congress. This should be something that is this should be a Democratic push. So it should start from Congress. And then the U.S. government should challenge American scientists and engineers to build a new facility here within the United States, an advanced research facility capable of producing burning plasma within a decade. We think this is possible, and we think it's doable. Call it an Apollo program, if you like. This will significantly cut down the time required until commercialization. And you can compare these Gantt charts with the prior Gantt charts, and you can see that it significantly moves forward the time in which we can start to commercialize fusion energy. Now, when we talk about long time spans and budgets and all of these things, it's only as important as when the rubber meets the road. But we believe that that's why we're looking at a 10-year plan. We know we're in budget time here on the Hill right now, and budgets last 10 years. So we think that it's important to get a 10-year plan out right now. Does that mean we expect to have a commercial power plant operating in 2023? No. This is an important long-term goal. We believe that if we make the investments now, start the plan, we can have steel in the ground and a facility that's operating in which we can make the necessary, really technological leaps forward and prove that this is something that in the future we can do. This breakthrough facility will pave the way to commercial fusion power in a time frame that's relevant to our national security. So a few more recommendations we have. First, the president should appoint a fusion power commissioner in order to streamline the leadership. One person to whom all of the fusion community can report. As we know in government, when you have a large group with many voices, it's sometimes difficult to get the movement. So appoint one person, begin construction of the facilities immediately, pursue multiple and parallel research paths. There are multiple options for fusion. Stuart mentioned inertial and magnetic. We need both. We need to be investing in both. There are other options for power plants throughout. We can't immediately down select. We need to have a real competition for what's the best options, what's the best way forward. We need to devote increased resources right now to our existing fusion research facilities. So these are our MIT, Princeton, D3D by General Atomics out in San Diego, as well as the research labs across the country. Many of these are running at well below capacity. We could be operating these without a significant new infrastructure investment, but just in terms of time and in terms of the people manning them, the graduate students that need to be on these machines and learning right away, who will be the basis for the era of commercialization. We need to be devoting those resources right away. We need to experiment with new and innovative power plant designs. And importantly, this can't be simply a government program. This has to be a program in which we cooperate fully with the private sector. You know, a lot of us here at ASP are involved with the national security community and the really the security industrial complex, the military industrial complex, is an example for how to work together between government and the private sector. We need to bring that across. So that's our plan, and that's where we think we can go. We think that this is will have some monumental achievements, and I'll turn back to Steve.
Andrew, thanks. I think you laid out a pretty good argument for it. We've listed here 10 achievements or 10 things that we think that Fusion will do for us. They're also in the report, so I won't read them all to you, but there's a lot of advantages to it, not the least of which is on the education side, STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, improving that in the country. It's clean. It kind of drives me crazy when I opened up yesterday's paper and see the Mars lunar rover walking around telling us that there might have been water on Mars a couple million years ago. When if you dedicate just a small portion of the money that's gone to NASA and put it over in the Fusion, we'd be powering our lights and we'd have heat here today with Fusion Power. Next slide. So these are all out there, and I think you understand the advantages to Fusion Power. It's not just a pie-in-the-sky dream. We have done fusion power here in the United States. We just haven't dedicated the resources to getting it done. Next slide. And that's the plan that we lay out here at ASP. I realize it's aggressive, it's a bit of a mouthful, but it's well within our capability to do this, and it would improve everybody's lifestyle, not just here, but worldwide as well. So we can do this if we get the effort behind it, if we get the government behind it, if we get DOE behind it, get people mobilized and energized about it. The science has proven, the technology hasn't quite caught up to it yet, but it can be, I'm convinced it can be done. People like Stuart Prager and others have proven that. So with that, that concludes, we're just about out of time here, that concludes our presentation. Let me open up to any Q&A or questions that any of you all might have about what our plan is here today. Or have I stunned you into silence? Yes, sir.
You showed us that countries like England, South Korea, China, Japan are constructing facilities that you are proposing that are built in the U.S. And the U.S. plan, your plan is to have something around 2035. Is that?
No, much shorter than that.
Okay, before then. So are those countries that you showed that are already constructing facilities, is their time scale a lot ahead of yours?
Andrew?
Certainly not. The facilities that we would propose would be more advanced and really cutting edge beyond what these facilities. And I'll let Stuart give.
I agree. The ASP plan would be as fast or faster than other nations. The nation that has the fastest plan, to my knowledge right now, is China. And this would at least match that. I think we could be able to do better because we have a more established workforce. So with even a similar kind of investment, the U.S. can move much more quickly. It's interesting. It takes about 20 years to build up a fusion science workforce. And China will have that in some number of years, but they don't have it as of this moment. Both China and true for Korea, too, in order to know how to even use their facilities best, they have to go to U.S. and European scientists to work with them.
Answer your question. Anybody else? Yes, sir.
This idea of a fusion power commissioner, there already is an associate director for fusion energy sciences. That person doesn't have control over the inertial combined facilities. Is that the idea, to have someone that's in charge of both inertial and magnetic?
Yeah, that's the idea. And frankly, probably if this were to have the level that we believe, the level of investment and the level of support, the level of national support that that we need, it probably should be a higher level person than
like
that.
A political appointee,
somebody who has the ability to go directly to the top, somebody who has the ability to cut through the bureaucracy, not somebody who can merely work within the established programs. It does take a long time to get things done within the government. We need to be able to cut through the red tape, cut through that. And so somebody with the personal connection to the highest level, as well as the personal capability to get that done through force of will as well as through, you know, the bureaucratic.
Yes, sir.
Sir, a quick follow-up on that. As mentioned, a lot of the commercial fusion is military research, and therefore in NNSA, there's some question about NNSA governance and what it's doing and whether fusion is a priority. Do you have a position on that, whether those programs should remain in the defense area, or any change or any position on that question?
Look, I mean, I think fusion is clearly a part of national security. Whether, you know, how you arrange the boxes within the government is not our job. That, you know, that's Congress's job. That's the government's job. So I don't think we have a real position.
Yeah, I mean,
line that up.
It's an energy source. It's not necessarily a defense-related item here. So we kind of leave that to Congress. My personal take in it, you know, belongs in DOE or somewhere similar.
But there's always the worry, of course, is that if you say, oh no, well, we put it all in one. If you just take that recommendation and don't deal with the funding side, that's, you can't just take a small part of this in one and then you know, do it without bumping up the funding. So this is, you can't just choose one or the other.
Yeah, another part of this is the regulatory side of it, and a lot associated with nuclear fusion. And as Stuart has pointed out, the risks are not even close to being the same. And so you've got to work through that side of the house,
yeah,
too.
You'd have to work through the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, yeah, once we do get to the point of that. And that's something that they haven't even begun to look at. But it should be easily surmounted. But that will take time. We think a commissioner could help streamline that process.
Yes, sir.
If I could ask an engineering question, please. So considering a tokamak or maybe an inertial swell, how do you get the energy from the plasma, you know, conducted into making steam? And you simply, you know, should go from here to here, but my understanding is, doesn't, if the plasma contacts the wall of the tokamak, does that not quench the plasma and you not have problems? And are there alternatives to extracting the energy that are not simply conduction of?
Okay. You asked a couple of questions there. One is, how does the energy go from the plasma into turning the turbine? So the answer there is the neutrons that are producing the reaction are not affected by the magnetic field because they're neutral particles, and they just bombard a blanket. The blanket captures the neutrons and it heats up, and it's kept at about 1,000 degrees C. There are challenges, material challenges, in designing and constructing that blanket, but that is how it's done. You touched on a second materials issue. You have a wall that is bombarded by that intense heat that comes from the plasma, so you have to have a material that can withstand that bombardment. Presently, we use tungsten, and it works, but all the existing experiments are for seconds long, and it has to work forever, so there's research goals there. For a tokamak, you know, that's how it's done, and there's no other way. There are other schemes that are imagined where you don't use it through the heat that comes out, but the charged particles stream out, and you do a direct conversion to electricity from the streaming charged particles, but that would be a non-tokamak concept. Does that answer your question?
And what is the blanket? What is that material?
The blanket has to have some lithium in it. It's various types of lithium structures, because the lithium absorbs the neutrons, and then there's a reaction that breeds tritium in the lithium blanket. So it's typically, for example, a lead-lithium structure is an example.
Yeah, liquid that circulates.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
You said that if things stay the same and you don't get the investment that you're seeking, are we looking for an academic and engineering brain drain of the United States into these other countries?
Because already happened. I think Stuart can talk to it better than I can, but
it's already there. that is starting to happen. Of course, there's sociological limits. People don't want to move to China necessarily and raise their kids there. But I was just in Germany at a meeting, and several young Germans, great scientists, got up to talk, and out of their mouths came American accents. They were young, great, young American scientists who want to work in the United States, and there isn't the jobs because of budget constraints, and they're, you know, stuck in Germany because the scientific opportunity there is greater. So this is a very, very big issue.
And, it's an important question too. And this will not just be the top level scientists. Of course, you'll have to have this, but this will catalyze extraordinary growth in engineering positions, in everything from constructing the magnets and the large facilities to operating it to the scientists who are needed to design it and everything. So this is an opportunity, and certainly we're already seeing them move abroad and move elsewhere.
Yes, ma'am.
About your recommendation for cooperation with the private sector, at what stage do you think that's best used? Are you talking about the commercialization stage?
Good question. It's a couple of things. First, when you cooperate fully with the private sector, we're talking about the base of the base of companies that provide to the Department of Energy or to the Fusion Power Commissioner and his group. So it's working with them to get the know-how into the private sector to be able to build these things. But it's also when you start talking about the utilities, at this point in the 10-year plan, this is not a demo power plant. This is not a demonstration power plant in the 10-year plan. But at some point, when we enter that age of commercialization, at the end of the 10-year plan, you're going to have to start seeing what the utilities need in order to run a power plant, in order to make this something that they're going to want. So you're going to have to partner with them. There's already the demand for this, of course. A large-scale facility that produces energy without waste will be wanted by the utilities. So it's just determining their needs and how that'll work. So I think that's important. But I think, throughout, there should be cooperation with the private sector and input. I think this will be kind of a binary back and forth. The private sector will bring good ideas in, and the government and the government labs will respond as well.
For those who read Ken Blanchard's books, Raving Fans is one of my favorites, and I would say that ASP is the number one raving fan of fusion energy and its potential, but I want you all to be raving fans too. If you have questions about fusion or where the future is in it or anything in that relation, just go to us, hit our website, call Andrew, call myself. We'll provide the info for you. We'll get you in touch with Dr. Prager and the NIF and the other places that all do this research. Fusion Power Associates, there's a great book that has just been put out, The Search for the Ultimate Energy Source, by Steve Dean, who's sitting right over there. I've not read the book yet, Steve, but I'm going to. I hope at least this has given you a background on fusion, that it's not some pie-in-the-sky stupid dream of a wild, crazy scientist out of Back to the Future. It's not. It's reality. We can do this, but we've just got to dedicate the resources to do it. Steve.
I could take 2 seconds. I'd just like to read a couple of quotes from this book.
Great.
Joe Gavin, who used to be on our board, he was a CEO, president of Grumman Corporation, and he was project manager for the lunar landing module in the 1960s. And in 1982, he said the following about the fusion program. A shorter program will cost less than a longer program. If you plan it for 50 years, it will take 50 years. If you plan it for 10 years, it might take 12. But at least it will be 12 instead of 50. And another quote from not directly on fusion, Henry Ford said, "Think you can or think you can't. Either way, you will be right." Well, Disney said, if you can dream it, you can do it. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt said in 1942, let no man say it cannot be done. It must be done. And we have undertaken to do it. So I appreciate all the work that the ASP is doing to help.
Steve, thank you. And Dr. Prager, Andrew, and Admiral Gunn, thank you all. Give them a big hand.